every weekday from 7.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show Friday Drive Time with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The Green Party are in Mayor Ferguson's cabinet, but Labour aren't. Gus Hoyt is here to explain what exactly he's doing for us. And Bilderberg reports this week strongly suggests the Western Mafia bosses are meeting in June in Watford. If you haven't heard of this private club of royalty, bankers, oil chiefs, arms manufacturers, media, including the BBC, and the super rich, well, you soon will, I hope. And bombs at the Boston finish line. Further developments today. So, is this blowback for America's war on Islam, or is there another agenda? And 20 years ago today, to the day, the two-month siege of the Branch Davidians community in Waco, Texas, came to a horrific end as Bradley tanks closed in on David Koresh and his Texas settlement. 76 people were killed, including 20 children. About the same number that died yesterday in the fertilizer plant explosion just outside Waco, Texas. So we're going to revisit those events, and we'll start, I think, with the fertilizer plant, Martin. What are your thoughts about that? This is just literally yesterday morning, or the evening before that, actually. Is it Wednesday evening? That massive explosion and many people dead. Is there any clues as to whether this is just a coincidental accident?
Well, I think it's too early to say. I mean, the problem with commenting about things like this that have happened 5 minutes ago is that all of the facts aren't out there.
But what about the obvious thing to me seems to be this is situated right in the middle, very, very close to a residential area. A fertiliser plant has gone up in the past.
The obvious points to make is that the fertiliser plant was obviously being mismanaged if it's an accident. And these kind of things, if you remember, in India, the big Bhopal explosion, which was Union Carbide, were behind that. The Seveso tragedy in northern Italy in the 1970s. And, often corporate corner cutting does lead to disasters and tragedies like that.
I mean, why aren't we learning lessons, though? Because fertiliser plants in the past have exploded over the last couple of hundred years. But since fertilisers have been around, surely we should be learning lessons and not citing these places in the middle of towns, for goodness sake. What are the Americans up to?
I mean, it's always a trade-off between money and profit and safety. And that's why you have to regulate markets to make sure that they're carried out safely.
You're making your socialist points, aren't you? But what about, Boston? This is really the big story from the beginning of the week, which is the two bombs that went off. It looks like they are pressure cooker bombs at the finish line. Now, the first thing I'll say about it is quite clearly somebody wanted to make sure that this was all recorded, because there'll be plenty of people making recordings at the finishing line. That's clearly why that spot was chosen.
Yes, and I've been trying to follow it on the internet as it's been developing hour by hour. Obviously, the suspicion in one's mind is that this is either a fairly low-level attack carried out by individuals with a grudge, or some kind of politics. And of course, you know, in Baghdad, this would hardly make local news in Baghdad. It would not be regarded as a major incident. But on the other hand, of course, the media impact of it is enormous, and there's always a question: who is pulling the strings here? What are they trying to achieve? And as we know, quite recently, Francesco Imposimosto, who is the head of the Supreme Court in Italy, has been saying, well, in actual fact, most of the bombings and shootings in Italy in the 70s and 80s were carried out by NATO intelligence services. So obviously the big question mark in my mind is, are NATO guilty in Boston? And I just don't know yet. We're waiting to find out.
Well, it doesn't look like it, because there are several people who have been named. And we've had also today a police officer shot dead on the Massachusetts Institute of Technology campus. So it looks like they have two terrorists. One of them's now been killed, but another one is still on the run.
Well, that doesn't... I mean, we've still got to find out who they are, who's been pulling
those
strings.
One of them looks like...
of course, we don't necessarily take at face value everything we're being told. There were definitely drills going on. We've got eyewitnesses saying...
How do you know that?
Because there's eyewitnesses and local media in Boston have been saying, although it's not been reported widely apart from on the internet, that there were sniffer dogs, drills. There was definitely some people there who were from a private security company, Kraft, Now, all of these things are still in the mix. People are still trying to work out what happened. I don't know what happened. I'm just trying to look at it and like everybody else. On the other hand, we do know that intelligence services carry out these kind of attacks in order to create certain kinds of
effects. As do ordinary terrorists.
Indeed.
Rather than...
They're all terrorists.
Can I just ask you to comment on this? Because one of the guys, it looks like the guy that they're after in Boston right now still, is a Chechen.
Well, yes, and the Chechens, of course, have been fighting with the Russians, but of course these guys fled Chechnya, as I understand it, and were actually getting sports scholarships in the US, and therefore, you know, why would they want to go and do something like this? We don't know yet, and of course people can be made to seem guilty who are not necessarily guilty. Think Lee Harvey Oswald. Now, in actual fact, people shouldn't jump to judgment about any of these things. They should wait until all the facts are assembled, and of course... presume that anybody could be behind this. It could be a small disgruntled group, it could be a wider terrorist group, or it could be the state itself, which also runs terrorist groups. Don't forget, Al-Qaeda was set up in the first place by Western intelligence services. Al-Nusra Front fighting in Syria now, carrying out bombings all the time, being supported indirectly by the West to overthrow Assad. You know, these kind of things are more complicated than people realise. It's not good guys with white hats and bad guys with black hats. It's much more complicated.
The guy apparently is called Dzhokhar Dzhuranev, who's a 19-year-old immigrant from Kyrgyzstan. Now, where is that? And why would someone like that have a grudge against America?
Well, we don't know enough to make any kind of judgments. Don't forget, the Chechens were blamed for bombing Moscow in 1999, which is when Putin came to power. And what Litvinenko was saying, no, it wasn't the Chechens who bombed Moscow. It was, in fact, the FSB, of which I was a member, the FSB being the KGB. In actual fact, when these incidents happen, there are all sorts of potential possibilities, and people should not presume that they know until all the facts are out. And all the facts aren't out about all sorts of things, even now. The bombing in Bologna in 1980, 9/11, 7/7, all of these things still remain mysteries.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, terrorists who plotted to blow up an army base in Britain with explosives on a toy car were jailed for 44 years this week. The gang were locked up after admitting the Al-Qaeda-inspired plot to attack the barracks using the deadly remote control vehicle. British terrorists were this week jailed for 44 years for plotting to blow up a territorial army base using an explosive-packed toy car. The gang were locked up after admitting the Al-Qaeda-inspired plot using a remote control vehicle. At one point they aimed to mount a suicide bombing campaign against British and US troops serving in Afghanistan, but apparently they lost contact with their handler in Pakistan, so they came back to Britain and started plotting here. The only reason that we know anything about this plot is that they had their cars bugged by MI5.
Well, it's gone before a jury, and the jury have decided that they are guilty. But I also ask the question, who was their handler in Pakistan? Are we sure we know? If it was an Al-Qaeda handler, who is Al-Qaeda? Who set up Al-Qaeda? Oh, it was set up by Western intelligence services. So can you see how people could be recruited into this kind of lunacy, but still be patsies and puppets of the intelligence services? That's, in fact, how normally these things are done. And basically, the Western intelligence services definitely did create Al-Qaeda. They make no bones about that. That is on the record. The question is, at what point did you lose control of Al-Qaeda? Or are you still in control of it?
Now, one of those jailed, Iqbal, had an Al-Qaeda contact in Pakistan dubbed Modern Sleeve, as his code word, by security services. The evidence shows Iqbal to have been acting as a facilitator for individuals who wanted to travel for extremist purposes, and he had direct contact with a Pakistani-based operative who, it's believed, facilitated the process at that end.
Yes, now who would that chap be? And who would he be working for? This is the questions that people have to ask themselves. Because don't forget, the security services have got a track record of creating incidents. And in actual fact, virtually every single person who's been arrested and convicted of terrorism in the United States since 9/11 has been set up by the FBI. They target the lonely, the lost, the despairing, the marginalised. And then they concoct plots, which they are recruited into, and then, magically, they rescue people from these plots, or sometimes they allow the plots to go ahead. The 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center was FBI plot from start to finish. They handed over explosives to the plotters and allowed them to let them off. And then, of course, arrested them all because it was their plot in the first place.
Now, I mean,
there's a track record of this stuff going on.
I've had a good look around, and it looks as if there was actually no explosive device put together at all, no toy car actually bought. But the other defendant, Ahmed, led military-style training trips to the countryside where he and fellow extremists were spotted jogging in formation whilst using logs as mock weapons. He suggested bungee jumping, skydiving, horse riding and paragliding as good jihad training in a bid to overcome his fear of heights, Woolwich Crown Court heard.
Well, all I can say is no provisional IRA person would be found jogging around the countryside with a log in his hand fantasizing about going whitewater rafting. These people are losers, and they are recruited to these madcap schemes by somebody. The question is who? Probably the same kind of people that have always been recruiting terrorists, that is to say, Western Intelligence Services and the Israelis. And there's a track record of them doing exactly that. That's exactly what has gone on.
Martin, well, at what point does some sort of silly fantasy talked about in a car saying, oh yes, we could put a remote control car under the gate there. What does that how does that turn into a serious terrorist criminal offence?
Well, it turns into a serious terrorist criminal offence when people start talking stupid things like that. If the question is, how serious are these people as terrorists? Now, in actual fact, they've got caught. And you know why they've probably got caught? It's because they've been infiltrated from all along. Possibly they've been infiltrated because the guy they made contact with in Pakistan is, in fact, an agent for the Western Intelligence Services, which then makes the whole thing
fit. Now, have you got any evidence for them doing that?
No, I haven't.
In the past?
No, in the past, very definitely. Very definitely. As I've said to me before, there is no dispute that the Al-Qaeda structure was created by the Western Intelligence Services under Operation Cyclone, for which MI6 was the lead agency. It's all in the history books. Now, at what point did Al-Qaeda go rogue and set off to do its own things? Well, I would argue it's never been a rogue agency. We've seen in Syria, for example, that many of the jihadi groups operating there with the support of Western Special Forces and Intelligence Services are, in fact, the enemy that we're supposed to be fighting. Now, what's actually happening is that behind the scenes, intelligence services, not just the Western intelligence services, including the Russian FSB, including the Indian Research and Analysis Wing, including the Pakistani Inter-Services Intelligence Agency, they are the ultimate perpetrators of terrorism, virtually 100%, apart from the odd nutcase.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
And Bilderberg comes to Watford. Couldn't make it up, could you, really? This is the Bilderberg Conference, which is an annual conference of really what you can only describe as a kind of European NATO zone super elite. This is the people that control most of the money in the Western world, along with arms companies, also royalty, bankers, media, as Marcus Aegeus, who seems to have one foot in Barclays and the other foot in the very top end of the BBC, Martin.
Well, yes, it's a very worrying situation, isn't it? So you remind me again what that was about?
This is the Bilderbergers. If we go through the steering group of Bilderberg, this is basically the... when the Bilderbergers themselves meet, it's about 120 people come to the conferences, but there's about 25 on their steering group. One of them is Marcus Aegeus, former chairman, who stepped down as chairman and then the next day started as chairman again at Barclays Bank, and he's also one of the executive directors of the BBC. One of the sort of people that comes to these conferences. Funny though that the BBC don't actually report it most years. We get no reporting at all.
Well, that's part of the deal, isn't it? In fact, Francesco Imposimato, who is the head of the Italian Supreme Court, who's the one who was basically pointing the finger at Western intelligence services behind terrorism in Italy, he's actually explicitly names Bilderberg as the terrorist, the head of the Italian Supreme Court, Francesco Imposimato. People can look him up on the internet. Last week he was saying Bilderberg are the terrorists.
Well, some of the main people, another one is from the UK, is Kenneth Clark, who's obviously a member of Parliament, but he's a minister without portfolio now, and he's a cabinet minister. He's going to be in the meeting. So where are his loyalties? Are they to the government or are they to Bilderberg?
Well, people are beginning to work out that behind the scenes there are very powerful people who are doing some very nasty things. I'll repeat for the third time, the head of the Italian Supreme Court is all over the Italian media this week saying that Bilderberg are behind terrorism in Italy, including the bombing of Bologna railway station in 1980, the kidnap of Aldo Moro, the prime minister, in 1979, etc., etc. That is the head of the Italian Supreme Court, with all of the resources of the Italian state behind him, presumably including things like the Carabinieri and the police. That is the reality, but you're not hearing it on the BBC.
Marcus Aegeus is making sure about that. Deutschland, one of their German participants on the steering group of Bilderberg, is Thomas Enders. Now, he's the chief executive of EADS, which is the biggest arms manufacturer on the continent.
Well, we're not really surprised. Bilderberg is where they get together the most powerful, wealthy string pullers on the planet. They're not the only place where they get together. Things like the Trilateral Commission and other secret groups meetings, which we probably know nothing about. But the fact of the matter is that there is overwhelming evidence, which has been collected over 30 or 40 years, that the Western elite is truly criminal. I noticed with our colleague earlier was saying he didn't believe that the drug cartels were propping up the banks. Well, the UN Office on Crime and Drugs begs to differ. The evidence is
also the US courts have prosecuted successfully prosecuted the HSBC for it. The Argentinian government are also now instituting court proceedings against HSBC for money laundering.
Well, exactly. I mean, the pattern is fairly clear. Basically, the elite in the West has step by step become entirely criminalised because of the sources of their funds. And law enforcement around the world is aware of this, but they're often not strong enough to do anything about it. And that, unfortunately, is the situation.
But this company, EADS, we only heard at the end of last year that they were possibly going to merge with BAE Systems. That would make them really almost a monopoly arms supplier for the whole of Europe.
Yes, and behind a lot of this arms supply...
This is drones, for example, everything.
The Carlyle Group. Which people can look up, massive organisation, got lots of ex-politicians on its
including
board.
John Major, of course.
Indeed, and
I don't know if he still is, but he certainly
was.
And
of course, what you've got is ex-politicians going into the industry to sell weaponry to the governments that they used to represent, which of course is a conflict of interest, but who cares?
Another one of the Bilderbergers is Craig J. Mundy. He's senior advisor to the chief executive at Microsoft. Another one is Jorma Olila, and that's chairman of Royal Dutch Shell. So these really are the big guys, aren't they?
Well, presumably there's a spectrum of people involved there. You know, you've got your big capos di tutti capi, and you've got various small fry who are along for the ride. But the fact of the matter is that we are dealing with organised crime at the top, including politicians, but they're merely errand boys by and large.
Also, another one who's definitely not an errand boy is Jean-Claude Trichet. He's honorary governor of the Bank of France and also former president of the European Central Bank. Obviously, he has quite a lot of weight still.
Well, I mean, as you know, for many years they pretended they didn't have any meetings at all and denied that they got together until eventually journalists like yourself forced them to admit that they do have these meetings every year and that they do attend them. And, of course, George Osborne attended one a couple of years ago, supposedly in a private capacity, but he took all of his Treasury civil servants with him. So he wasn't in a private capacity at all, but although he denied that he attended, then he said he had attended, then he said he'd attended in a private capacity, but it turns out no Treasury civil servants were with him as well. So we're basically being told a load of fibs about it.
So the hotel is called The Grove. It's actually not just an ordinary hotel. It's got a giant golf course attached to it, just on the edge of Watford. It looks like between the 5th and the 8th of June 2013, but it's almost impossible to confirm this because the hotel won't confirm whether it's Bilderberg or not, and Bilderberg office in Leiden in Holland will never actually confirm or deny until the last guest has left as to whether it is actually a Bilderberg conference or not.
Well, they've been caught most years in recent years, haven't they, wherever they've had
they
it.
Certainly have.
They're in the US last year and they certainly faced opposition there, didn't they?
And irony of ironies, the police chief for Hertfordshire, which is where this particular conference is going to take place, it looks like, a police chief has called for the public to intervene more when they see crimes being committed because of a fall in citizens' arrests leaves society at risk. The Hertfordshire Police and Crime Commissioner, David Lloyd, this week said too many people fail to intervene because they thought it was only the job of the police.
Well, I wonder if he's cleared that with the police, because their advice is basically, unless it's a very minor thing, like you're dealing with a school child, your best bet is not to intervene, but to leave it to those who know.
But I mean,
what
isn't
doing.
It a bit of a no-brainer? He said, this is David Lloyd, who's the Police and Crime Commissioner for Hertfordshire, where this Bilderberg conference is taking place. He said, there's a tendency to turn a blind eye and not even bother to report things to the police.
No doubt stuff about Bilderberg would be way over his head. Maybe we should report Bilderberg to the police and the local police should go in there and arrest them. Francesco Imposimato, I'll repeat his name for the fourth time, the head of the Italian Supreme Court, as far as he's concerned, Bilderberg are terrorists.
What about the possibility of, because Henry Kissinger will be there, many countries of the world, he is not allowed to go.
He's a terrorist.
Sorry?
Regarded by many people as a terrorist and by many law enforcement agencies.
And what about, say, for example, oil executives who've been fixing the price at least, this is according to international estimates, at least $35 a barrel above the market price for at least a decade. These oil executives have been fixing the price. Isn't that a crime?
I'm afraid it is, but nothing is going to be done about it until the system cracks, which I'm afraid that's what it will take. the system will crack, and then people's eyes will be opened, and then something may be done about all of this. But the rot is very deep. It's been there a long time. It's going to take a big operation to get rid of it.
Well, I think we have to say well done to Charlie Skelton at The Guardian and various other people for tracking down this year's venue. It's buzzing around on the internet. Many people around the world starting to look at ticket prices and whereabouts they're going to stay nearby to the conference. Because one of the great things about this, Martin, is when all these mafia dons get together, also people who are campaigning against it also turn up, and then they network with each other. They have, in a way, a kind of alternative conference, and they're sharing information online and also talking to mainstream journalists about this. So there's a kind of, in a way, a little bit like the other economic summit that was, you know, you were involved with a bit with the New Economics Foundation, came after the G8 meetings. You've got another kind of alternative growing up alongside the Bilderberg as a sort of competing conference against it.
Well, sunlight is the best disinfectant. Let's throw open the windows and see what we find. I'm sure it's going to be messy and it's not going to be pleasant, but let's get it over with.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
And as I mentioned before, it's exactly 20 years since the end of the Waco siege. Martin, this is something which is literally just down the road from where that massive fertiliser explosion happened in that fertiliser factory. Just give us a bit of an introduction as to how it happened, because it was going on for something like 2 months, this siege.
The Waco siege. Well, I'm not an expert on the Waco siege. It seems that analysis made afterwards, and also the Oklahoma bombing, that they may fit into this pattern of NATO intelligence destabilisation. So what they're doing is creating what in British Army slang would be called counter gangs, that is to say right-wing, left-wing, individual loony terrorists, and basically creating an enemy within.
But it was, well,
and,
I mean,
this fits a pattern.
Well, yes, but with Waco, they weren't a cult, they were just a community, basically, and because there was some local people reported possible firearms violations there, rather than arrest people maybe while they were off the complex, they decided to turn up literally with lots and lots of guns and surround the place, which then led to a standoff, didn't it? Do you think maybe just bad tactics in the first place?
It may be, and it may be that the authorities are just bungling and incompetent, or it may be that they're genuinely trying to create a problem that they can then resolve. I think the jury's out on Waco. I know plenty of people in the US think that the government were involved. I don't know enough about it to be sure. I'm certainly sure.
Well, the government were involved, certainly in the way it turned out. But wasn't it just a refusal by the authorities to admit that maybe they got it wrong? They should have backed off and started again, and they just refused to do that.
Which is not as sinister as them basically turning the whole thing into a media spectacle, which is what's suspected.
Okay, and there is a very good film about it. If you haven't watched it, it's quite long. It's nearly 2 hours long. But it's called Waco Rules of Engagement. And we'll have a little couple of extracts from that now.
Until Waco, most Americans had never heard of the Branch Davidians or their leader, David Koresh.
The Branch Davidians are a breakoff from the Seventh-day Adventist Church. The history of the group goes back for about 50 years, long before David Koresh was even born.
So I think there was a big effort to mount this through the media in terms of its spin, that this was a crazy cult that everybody had good reason to be afraid of.
He actually drove right through the middle of the building into the kitchen area, and basically at point-blank range where the women and children were.
A horrible, horrible way to die.
They were all good people. They minded their own business. They were never overbearing. I liked them.
Hello?
They just come in and kill me.
Nobody's coming in there. You got my word. It's solid, okay?
Well, that's some pretty poignant stuff at the end there, particularly the little child, Martin, saying, "Are you going to come in and kill me?" And the man saying, "No, we're definitely not going to come in," promising that they wouldn't, which of course they did. And before that, there was the local sheriff saying, well, basically they were really nice people.
Well, yes, and these questions are still hanging over this incident after all these years. As I coming back to what we were talking about earlier about Bilderberg, there is overwhelming evidence that the NATO intelligence services have been involved in provoking acts of terrorism. We need to get to grips with that, because that's a systematic problem.
One of the best commentators on Waco for me is one of the local comedian, Bill Hicks. Let's see what he had to say.
Down in Australia when the Waco debacle ended, and I was very bummed because I thought that was the most fascinating story of the year, bar none. And everyone was so upset with that guy because he called himself Jesus, right? And I said, come on, you know, the guy's real name is Vernon. Let him be Jesus for a couple of months. You know what I mean? What's it to you? Who's going to follow a Messiah named Vernon anyway? You got to be Jesus. That's part of the Messiah deal. And Vernon's bake. Yeah, yeah. What are we doing? I'm following Vernon. Where y'all going? To the drive-in. Joe Bob Briggs said the movie was real good. Vernon's going. He's my Messiah. Isn't that weird, though? People always snap and think they're Jesus. How come no one ever snaps and thinks they're Buddha? Particularly in America, where more people resemble Buddha than Jesus. I'm Buddha. Come over here and read my scripture. Vernon's a false prophet. But I thought the whole thing was an absolute disaster and a debacle. And if any of y'all have been watching public access and seen the footage, which was not shown on any major news media source, of the tanks, Bradley tanks, shooting fire into the compound, which I think went against the party line story, which was that they shot tear gas in order to help the mothers and the children to get out, to convince them while they're destroying the compound, they're getting the mom and children out. The soft sell is definitely the FBI's way. And anyway, so the major news said that the Branch Davidians started the fire. If I'm not mistaken, correct me when I go off the story here. And that the Branch Davidians started the fire, and all they did was shoot in tear gas. And yet I've seen with my own eyes and my squeegee third eye footage of a Bradley tank shooting fire into the compound, which... Isn't that odd that no major news source has picked up on that? How do you think that's newsworthy? Because that basically means that the government, from the FBI, the ATF, up to Janet Reno, including Clinton, are liars and murderers. And wait, there's more. And, I mean, the implications are vast. You know, and if the ATF and FBI had any honor, if there was any honor left or dignity on this planet, they would commit Harry Caray while first admitting what they've done, and they'd kill themselves, because they are liars and murderers. Yeah. We had to bust the compound down because we heard child molestation was going on. Yeah, if that's true, how come we don't see Bradley tanks knocking down Catholic churches? I'm talking if child molestation is actually your concern. Well, there was a methamphetamine lab on the thing. No, there wasn't. And not one child came out of there saying they were molested. Not one child. They don't want the voice of reason spoken, folks, because otherwise we'd be free, and otherwise we wouldn't believe their lies, nor the propaganda machine, the mainstream media, and buy their products that we don't need and become a third world consumer plantation, which is what we're becoming. They are liars and murderers. All governments are liars and murderers. And I am now Jesus. Now.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
That was Bill Hicks, and he's a local lad from Texas, from Austin, Texas, and his commentary on Waco, which I think pretty much says it all. And I'm joined now by Gus Hoyt, who's not only a Green Councillor for Ashley, but he's also one of the charmed circle of Mayor Ferguson in the Cabinet. Now, Gus, welcome to Drive Time. How often does the Cabinet actually meet?
Well, the Cabinet as itself, it depends sort of, I suppose you sort of have to describe, you know, Cabinet and meet, because obviously everyone's off busy doing their own thing quite a lot of the time.
But do you have a sort of get together where everyone is together? How often?
I mean, essentially we have a every 2 weeks we have what we call a get together, which is just sort of briefing everybody and making sure everyone's aware of the issues which are going on.
So it sounds like almost like that's down the pub or something, a get together rather than some sort of formal thing.
That is a very informal meeting, yes. And then we have every 4 weeks we have a meeting of full Cabinet and SLT, who are the lead officers, strategic officers. And
what does that stand for, SLT?
Oh gosh, you caught me.
You go.
I've just got off my bike cycle here. Senior level
team. Yes. All right.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay, so
they're
just
top brass,
spell it out for us. Who is actually on this Cabinet now?
Well, at the moment, and obviously it might all change after the local elections week on Thursday, isn't it?
Yep.
There's myself, there's Guy Pulteney, there's Simon Cook, Barbara Jank, Jeff Gollop, and Alastair Watson, and of course, George.
Yeah. Okay. So, as a Green, you must have had some soul searching before actually going on to that cabinet, because many people will see, well, actually, Gus is part of the problem. He's part of the cuts. He's actually in there implementing cuts. Surely, it's not going to be good for you electorally.
Well, actually, I think sort of rising to the challenges and actually joining the cabinet shows greater responsibility than just sort of throwing toys out of a pram and not joining. We did have quite a lot of soul searching over whether we should join or not. In the local party, it was a local party decision, had nothing to do with London. We didn't have any interference from Caroline or anyone else like that. Local decision, and there were a few abstentions, and we've lost a few members. I will throw that out there. We have had some that have resigned in protest from me joining what is known as the Cuts Cabinet. But realistically, and I'm not trying to wash my hands of this in any sort of by any stretch, but the cuts are being a central government cuts. They're literally taking away our funding, and this is what we need to fight. It's no good just blaming the people who are there. Though I fully understand that I will have to make some decisions as to what services get less funding and so forth within my portfolios, and it's a very difficult job.
I mean, haven't you really essentially been implementing Simon Cook's budget? Because George Ferguson came in really at the end of last year. The budget is pretty much drawn up by that time. I mean, all he's going to do is shuffle a few things around. So essentially, you're basically there doing the dirty work, if you want, for the Liberal Democrats.
No, I wouldn't say that. And a lot of the budget does get drawn up beforehand. There's a lot of stuff that's statutory that we have to do anyway, that we have to fund, and that will continue. This budget, yes, because of the November elections, which was a crazy time to hold the elections, George and the cabinet, when we were chosen, and it was a slimline cabinet then, if I remember rightly as well, there were just four of us, we were thrown right in at the deep end. But essentially what we were given were a list of sort of alternatives and the costs, what services did we want, could we lose, what ones could we slim down on, and which ones we had to protect. For example, the budget which we were handed as it was, including closing all public toilets, and I was the first one to jump up and say, that's something we need to protect. And I think the cost for that is, it's just a lot of money. It's like 600,000 a year across the city, and we will need to look at ways to recoup some of that money, but closing them is not an option, and luckily George agreed. So
well, I mean, the thing is, if you go actually from South Gloucestershire into Bristol, you'll notice that a lot of public toilets in Bristol
have been closed already.
Sold off. Some of them sold off, some of them still derelict.
Yeah, and that was the Lib Dem.
I mean, if we're paying our council tax, which we are, almost everybody now is having to pay council tax. I mean, there's been a little bit of reining back by George saying, no, I'm not going to force people on benefits to pay it, because obviously they can't. The benefits that's are there right, yeah. for them to just feed their family and make sure that they've got a little bit of heat in their
home. That's being cut now, of course, by central government, let's not forget.
What are people actually paying for if you can't even fund things like public toilets? What are you able to fund?
Well, that's it. I mean, essentially this is the debate which George sort of wants to bring to the city. I know there's an event at the Watershed, but I'm hoping that it's going to involve much wider consultation, including hopefully neighbourhood partnerships, so it's not just a councillor thing. It actually goes down to the streets and finds out what the people of Bristol want to prioritise. Like I said, there is statutory things we have to provide, such as looking after children, elderly, all that sort of thing. There's no way we'd cut that anyway, even if that was an option.
But elderly care homes have been closed, haven't they? I mean, I was going past one up in Fishponds the other day. It's all just a kind of, I think it's being sold, imagine it's just being sold off to developers.
I think three were sold, and that was passed last year. The decision was made by that.
But how does that work? If you've got a statutory duty to look after elderly people, some of whom, really seriously cannot get around. I mean, if we can't look after people in the twilight of their lives, I mean, we're not really living in a civilised city, are we?
No, and though I may be in the cabinet, I'm not going to defend the previous administration's policies there. We're, as a Green, I'm strictly against privatisation. The route that they have gone down, because some of the care homes were in incredible disrepair, and some of them were, very under-occupied, the line they took is not one that I'd be advising now were on the cabinet then.
Looking just a little bit at more, I suppose, at the sort of democracy of all this, are the public actually allowed to see minutes of your cabinet meetings? Are the public allowed into cabinet meetings?
Yeah, that's what I was saying, but it sort of depends what description of cabinet meeting it is, because we had the cabinet get together, which is literally, you know, you could probably dress up as guys in the back room smoking cigars if you wanted to, but yes, that is unminuted. It's literally just an information sharing process. We have the meeting with the SLT team as well, and we also have, of course, our proper cabinet meetings where we actually discuss the business, and those are actually being held in public. They've always been held in public, but what we're trying to do now with this administration is actually hold them out in communities as well. So the first one was in Hartcliffe, and the most recent one was in Southmead. Yeah, that's right, up in Southmead. So,
but what I mean, the SLT meetings, which is with the senior council managers, those are. How available are they for people to see? I mean, can you actually come and sit and watch those if you want? I don't know how many people actually ever bother, but of course, as a principle, it is very important. I mean, one of the things, for example, people wouldn't necessarily know about the attempts to sell off public spaces 2 years ago if it hadn't been for the public and press being allowed into these meetings.
Yeah, and I've literally just cycled over from a protest to save some local allotments, actually, in St Werburgh's. Saving green spaces is something that I'll always be committed to.
Well, tell us about that. Yeah. Why are the council selling off those? Is it the council?
No, it's private land, and basically it's the money's not there, and they're going into liquidification, and I have actually, as you know, cabinet member responsible now for green spaces, told my officers that, you know, unless there's a completely unreasonable fee, that we're to work with them and try and do everything we can to buy them back and actually let the public continue using them, because once a green space is gone, it's gone. You know, we
the
can't
trouble
get
is, of course, the council unless tend to be like shedding destroyed. Land and selling land off, not buying it.
Yes, at the moment that does tend to be the case, especially with the properties. You know, it's we've got quite a lot of properties that aren't really being used, and as you know, with the slimming down of the actual council itself, we're bringing lots more workers into more custom, into buildings that make much more sense, bringing departments together so that they're not just, you know, left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing, and that does free up buildings that we can then sell to make more money.
Now, the city deal, this is something which was signed last year by Nick Clegg when he was in. Mm-hmm. Daniela Radice, who's your Green mayor candidate, pointed out on the debate that we did here at BCFM one Friday, just before the couple of Fridays before the mayoral election, that actually what's happening is that the management of the land, and Bristol apparently has got a massive portfolio of land and buildings, one of the biggest as a proportion of its actual area of anywhere in the country, that's being sort of farmed out, really, to something called the Public Property Board, which is I guess so many of these organisations are quite difficult, but it's the local enterprise partnership, and those meetings are quite quiet and secret. So why is it that the city council itself can't manage this land, that it has to actually hand it over to the private sector to manage?
Well, again, that's something which, you know, as a Green, and I'd, you know, completely agree with Daniela, and we did work on that policy together. You know, we do oppose that. I will continue to oppose that. Unfortunately, that's not in my portfolio at the moment. That is actually, I believe that's in the planning portfolio, which I think at the moment is with Guy Pulteney.
Right, so is this going to happen? I mean, are the private sector going to get their hands on our land?
At the moment, it looks like it's going ahead, yeah.
Okay, so this is something called the Public Property Board.
And I'm not personally involved in it.
We had James Jury on here, who's a part of the local enterprise partnership, and he was having to admit eventually that actually none of these meetings are going to be open to the public. So they're going to be basically dishing out land. They're going to be possibly selling it, or at least recommending it sold. Without any kind of public scrutiny, so things will start popping up. The use of land won't be really, even though it's public land, won't be available to us anymore. I mean, surely that, Gus, you know, that cannot be allowed to happen.
It absolutely shouldn't. Unfortunately, like I said, you know, that's not in my portfolio, and no, that sounds like I'm washing my
hands. So we have to get Guy Pawney in here.
I'd advise getting Guy in, yes.
Put him on the rack and ask him about that.
But ultimately, of course, you know, something which we do have to realise, and this, you know, don't forget, I was in here one time, I think, campaigning against having an elected mayor. When you do centralise all the power in an administration, you centralise it to one person. So ultimately, you know, that is a mayoral decision. So though Guy might be able to give you a steer on it and what he'd advise, because we're advisory mayors, we're not actually executive members, as was previously the case, you know, it's a decision.
Oh, right, so you're just advisors, really?
Essentially, yeah. Yeah, anything over £50,000 has to still sort of get the sign-off from George.
And Matthew Payne from KPMG, who's a volunteer advisor. This is something else I wanted to ask you about, because, I mean, I haven't had a reply back yet, but I've asked the City Council to explain why KPMG, the financial services firm, are being used, a guy called Matt Payne, who's an employee of theirs, as a volunteer to assist in going through accounts of the City Council, when there are two separate investigations at a national level into KPMG. First of all, for price fixing with the other big four accountancy firms, and secondly, the directors actually they're possibly going to be prosecuted for signing off accounts of the banks in the run up to 2008, which proved to be complete nonsense. So, if they can't sign off the accounts of the banks in the run up to the 2008 financial crisis, what makes you think that Matt Payne is the right guy to sign off our city accounts?
Yeah, and if you want, you know, suggested people to come in and talk about that one, I'd suggest you've mentioned it already. Daniela Radici, she's been very critical of that, and has also pointed out quite rightly that we think the voluntary sector is greatly underrepresented on that group.
Okay, so I mean, he's a volunteer, but he's actually from KPMG. Sounds a bit bizarre. Also, the council is relegated in people's minds. Stephen Lansdowne, Bristol City, not the council, Bristol City.
Didn't realise we were responsible.
I've got two things going on in my head at the same time here. Bristol City have been relegated, right? But also in people's minds, you know, Stephen Lansdowne hasn't been a great leader of our football team. Neither necessarily. I mean, he's done very well with his business. But what are your thoughts about the city's relationship with the football club and let's start with just with the football club and what they've been doing, particularly with planning. Because many people are still wondering, are they going to get this gigantic stadium at Ashton Vale?
Well, that's a good question as well. And, you know, essentially that comes down to quite a few things. I mean, the BRT route has to go somewhere through there if it's going to go through there. There's still quite a lot of, you know, local resident issues that I'll be quite open and say there's quite a few, you know, legitimacy issues with the decisions that have been made already from a planning point of view. In my perspective, I sit on a developmental control committee myself. And all the alarm bells were going off, especially with the Sainsbury's development, which is, you know, yet another way that that supermarkets have bribed their way into communities. You know, this time, you know, their tactic is using a football team. They've used it twice now successfully in the city, and it will come at a great cost to our local high streets.
I think I might bring Martin Summers in here, Martin, because we've had a bit of a momentous occasion of the relegation of Bristol City. Stephen Lansdowne was sort of as the owner had come in to sort of save the thing, and it all seems to be going downhill. Is it fair to say that? Because of the financial situation at Bristol City Football Club, that they really do have to do one of these sort of planning deals where they buy a piece of cheap land, agricultural land, and get planning permission on it in order to build a stadium. That's the only way that the company can actually survive, that they can keep their books balanced.
Well, I'm not an expert on this, so I wouldn't like to make some kind of expert opinion about it, but the economics of football clubs are becoming increasingly bizarre. You've got Bristol City are sort of sliding into the zone where, you know, they're not part of the mainstream football game, as it were, and therefore they gradually get worse and worse. But of course you've got Manchester United, who are one of the most successful football teams in the world, and they're also having problems because they've been bought out in a leveraged buyout. And so gradually what's happening is that these football clubs, which have got a history of being rooted in certain communities and having a certain kind of following, are gradually being sorted out into the losers, which may unfortunately be Bristol City, and the winners, the Man Cities, the Man Uniteds, who are just being used as cash cows for billionaires.
Okay, Gus, what are the plans for the stadium?
Well, I mean, essentially, yes, it was going to be moved out to the agricultural land, which, you know, previously said strongly against. That was their plan A, of course. They did recently come up with a plan B, which was to greatly improve the stadium where it currently exists. And that's something which I know a lot of the local campaigners were fighting for as well. So, you know, basically, I'm hoping their plan B is essentially their new plan A. And they go ahead with that because that will solve us lots of problems. You know, stop supermarkets coming in, keep the football club there, and essentially, save all the local residents as well.
Okay, you were talking earlier about the bus rapid transit. Is this actually going to happen? Is it going to happen? I mean, we have all these sort of highfalutin public transport schemes for at least 20 years in the city. They've been suggested. and lots of money has been spent on drawing up plans for them, you know, where exactly these little tram lines are going to go through the city, where the routes are going to go, and then we hear, sorry, but Bristol has just not managed to get its act together, so it's missed the deadline for the funding. And it does seem like that may be happening with the bus rapid transit again. Lots of very serious objections as to which routes it's taking, this kind of thing, and even as to whether the whole thing was a good idea in the first place.
Yeah, well, I've been a very vocal critic of the bus rapid transport system, and
but you're green. Surely you should want. Surely you
I want
should
good
want
traffic solutions.
Surely you should
not
want
just make
better
it worse.
Public transport,
and including the South Bristol Link, which is basically a ring road by any other name. No, I don't support the building of roads through premium
agriculture. But is that something that comes with this bus rapid transit?
Yes, there's three elements: the north south, the east west, and then a ring road essentially built onto South Bristol. Yeah, I've been fighting it. The north-south route, to be honest, does have some positive things. I'm not all against that one, and that will help a lot of commuters coming in.
It's a bit of a no-brainer,
again,
isn't it? You've got
some allotments,
all the way around,
need to be saved.
All the way around the east side of the city. Yeah. You've got a ring road, and then it just conks out.
Yeah, I mean, essentially what we need to be focusing on, you mentioned tram lines there earlier, you know, ultralight rail and improving the current rail system that we have. Fosborough have quite a few very good campaigns on at the moment to first off bring down the cost.
Fosborough is Friends of
Friends
South
of
Bristol,
suburban
Bristol Light, Railway. Yeah,
yeah, Bristol Rail.
But isn't this bus rapid transit system, Gus, isn't it really a perfect little halfway house between the buses that we've already got and some kind of tram system, which could be very disruptive and extremely expensive?
It is kind of like a halfway house. Personally, if we're going to spend hundreds of millions of pounds on a transport solution, I think we should look for a real solution and one that works, not a half-baked one. And that's what George is working on at the moment.
Okay.
But it's got to link in with the rail.
Okay, so if we're not going to do the bus rapid transit, what's your vision as a green vision for public transport in the city?
Well, you know, as I said earlier, you know, it's an investment in local rail, preferably if it's publicly owned. It's light rail as well, so it's essentially trams which can also go on the existing railways, connecting them all up. People do like trains, people use trains, buses. If they use proper hybrid buses, they could be used in areas, but not as the main mode of transport. And also, of course, huge cycling infrastructure, because most Bristol roads still aren't safe to cycle on. I almost got knocked over again on my way here, but I was rushing a bit.
No, don't rush so much. Like, it's not necessary. We'll stick some music on or something. No need to rush too much to get here, Gus. Don't put your life at risk, for goodness sake. Anyway, just in your own portfolio, what is your personal vision for the city?
Oh gosh, my perfect vision for the city. Essentially I have environment, communities and equalities, so what I'd like to see is a fair, equal city. We can lead by example, I think, on Bristol City Council. We have lots of great equality policies, but they're not always put into practice, and that's something I hope to change. As far as the environment goes, obviously I'd like to be a zero carbon city as quickly as possible.
What does that mean, a zero carbon? Yeah. I mean, I'm made of carbon.
Yeah. Okay.
A zero carbon city.
Yeah, we're not trying to eradicate all forms of human life by a zero carbon city. No, it's essentially going down so there's no actual carbon emissions being put out into the atmosphere. So, for example, all of our energy uses will be energy, and including heat, that is, will be made through renewable and planet friendly sources.
So is that loads of windmills everywhere, all over Dundry Hill and all that? I'm not sure if the planes would like that on the way into Bristol Airport.
I think getting rid of the planes would probably be a good thing as well, actually. Most polluting form of transport you can get. Essentially you'd be looking at a myriad of solutions. So you'd be looking at wind where it's right for wind, solar where solar fits, you know, covering every flat or south-facing roof. Looking at geothermal, looking at biomass burners, you know, the list goes on and on, and basically no one technology will ever fix it. It's got to be a mix of everything.
Now,
and hopefully have as many community-owned energy companies.
I have to say, I totally agree with you, but I mean, we had loads and loads of these solar panels appeared on people's houses, didn't they, in the previous Labour government, and then as soon as the coalition got in, that seemed to stop. I mean, is there any way that the Green Party could actually finance people putting solar panels, more solar panels on their own places. And also, of course, what about people who don't own their own roofs? Mm-hmm. You know, maybe it's, you know, either for a private landlord or a housing association or the city council. What about getting some solar panels on those roofs?
Yep. Well, as far as the Green Party funding it, I mean, you know, we struggle with finding enough money for leaflets. So I don't but think where, we can fund, I mean, you know, it directly.
Is it actually affordable
yes,
to do this?
Yes, absolutely. It's actually profitable. At the moment, if I could get any major loans, I would be focusing all of my time. If I was an entrepreneur, I'll be focusing all of my time forming a green energy company. The payback.
Well, they already exist. I think it's the guy's name's David Saunders. He was on here a couple of weeks ago talking about all this.
He's certainly doing that
on
himself.
Bristol Power.
Essentially the payback is 5 to 7 years. After that, you're looking at pure profit. So, I mean, not going down the green route seems ludicrous for me. It's just going to cost more and more money as resources get more and more scarce, and we're going to end up literally destroying the planet.
Finally, on a more personal note, you know, you've been at the top table with Mr. Ferguson. How's it been? Has it been as you were expecting?
Well, I never expected to sit on the cabinet at all. I've always been a bit of a troublemaker, and well, luckily I've still kept that. But it's been very interesting, I suppose, could be a key word that could describe it. I mean, the whole of the work in a city council has now changed. We've got an elected mayor. It's no longer run by the just the person who had the party that had the most votes, which is quite interesting because a lot of people for this local election are still campaigning as if they are campaigning for the running of the city, which they're not. But essentially, no, interesting is a word that keeps coming back. I mean, I don't always agree with everything that's being discussed.
How much power do you feel you actually have as an individual?
It's actually influence, which is
over our tax. Essentially, this is what your job is to make sure that our taxes are spent in the wisest possible way.
Yeah, absolutely. And essentially, what I'm trying to work with is partnerships, not just within departments, but actually outside. I'm not talking about just with the private sector, but with community groups and a lot of neighbourhood organisations. No one organisation at the moment has the funds or the capability to deliver everything on our own, and it's all about working with people. Well, working sort of the buzzwords are horizontally as well as vertically, but basically with other people, with other local authorities, other cities, not just around the UK, but around the world. Really, we need to learn from everybody and share our learning and our mistakes as well. But essentially, yes, it's we are in charge of taxpayers' money, and that's a burden that that rests very heavily on all the decisions that I make.
Well, Gus Hoyt, councillor for Ashley, and also at the top table with Mayor Ferguson in the cabinet, thanks very much for joining us on Drive Time.
Thanks very much, Tony.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Well, Oliver Stone referred to him in the film JFK as Mr. X. He was a colonel in the US Army and famously wrote a book called The Secret Team in Retirement, which the CIA tried to buy up all copies of to stop us from reading it, and failed. His name's Fletcher Prouty, and he gave us the world a fascinating insight into how the US and our leaders think. Here he is speaking in 1993 about colonialism. Certainly not the national curriculum view of history.
The British Empire had been built on the control of the sea. They were able to drive ships around the world. They knew the world was a sphere. A flat world had gone out. But knowing that the world is a sphere is a very important thing for mankind. It means its surface is finite. And if it's finite, then there's not more space over there and more there. So they began immediately to inventory Earth. And this was one of the jobs of the East India companies. And Thomas Malthus, who taught at Haileybury College, which was the East India College, was the director of economics there. He was the first person ever assigned to the job of inventorying the Earth. Where does tin come from? Where does iron come from? And so on. And in the process, they began to find out how many different people there were in the world, how many different types of people, how many races of people, and where everything was, began to map the world. Well, that's a very important function, but it leads you to one more thing that has governed relationship between countries ever since then, because Malthus came up with this idea that the population is growing ever so much faster than the ability to raise food. And therefore, it wouldn't be long before mankind would run out of food and there would be a terrible loss of life. And it was very convenient that Darwin came along, working for the same employer, the East India Company, with the idea that, well, life is a race for the survival of the fittest anyway, and so the fittest survive. Now, those two theories, which are propaganda, sort of made it legal for people who invaded, the colonialists, to kill off a couple hundred thousand people, because first of all, they probably weren't going to get to eat anyway, and certainly they weren't the fittest, because they're not alive now, they're dead, we're the fittest. It backed up the idea of this proprietary colonialism that swept the world from that period right on up into the 19th century, and in some respects applies today, because look what's going on in Europe. Look what went on in Vietnam, where hundreds of thousands of people were killed. And the feeling was, you know, what they used to call the mere gook idea, that, well, it doesn't matter. They're not going to live anyway. It's a very powerful underpinning to the civilization today.
That's Fletcher Prouty, Martin. Who is he?
Fletcher Prouty or Malthus? Yes. And well, I'm not sure. I've just heard his stuff there that you've managed to put together. You tell us who he is.
Well, he was just a very, very interesting guy. The book The Secret Team is really shows a kind of fascistic element to the US CIA post World War II. Anyway, time to sign off now, because it's time for the typical topical Afro Tropical show. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Deputy Leader of the Conservative Group and Councillor for Henbury, Mark Weston. Thanks also to Gus Hoyt, Cabinet Member, Councillor for Ashley, and to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Next week, last show before the local elections.
BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, the uncle of one of the suspects in the Boston bombings has told his nephew to hand himself in. Large parts of the city have been in lockdown as police search for Jahar Sanayev. His brother was earlier...